This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This has been a year of caution with regard to the economy. Things look to be improving, and if home sales and house prices in Charlotte are any indication, they are. But the stock market had other ideas. The beginning of the year was like riding a roller coaster, but then things settled down, and stock prices overall appeared to be on an escalator. Until Brexit. When England voted to exit the European Union, investors worldwide were shaken, and that uncertainty was reflected in plummeting stock markets and fears over what this shuffling of the deck might do to economies around the world. But on Tuesday and Wednesday, despite continued economic uncertainty, American stock markets and some stock markets around the world were back and were beginning to erase some of those Brexit losses. So what does all this mean to you and your 401k? What does Brexit mean for the economy? What should we make of the fact that before Brexit, the job market in the U.S. churned out the fewest jobs in 5 years? And with banking jobs being shed in that industry, what can the thousands of people employed at the banks here expect for the rest of the year? To get answers to those and other questions, we welcome Tim Quinlan, senior economist at Wells Fargo. Welcome back to the program. He joins us in our studio with us by phone from his vacation. This is dedication, by the way, is Dr. John Connaughton, professor of financial economics at UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business and the keeper of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast for North Carolina. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. And also with us is Dion Roberts, the banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who returns, I think, second time in 2 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm on a roll.
You're getting to be regular here. So the first half of the year, Has it turned out, Tim, to be what you expected?
Yeah, I think the biggest change relative to expectations between, you know, the end of the year and now is you had the Fed raise rates back in December, and they had kind of laid out a expected trajectory with 4 rate increases between that point and the end of this year. And here we are halfway through the year, and they've not yet delivered on another rate increase.
And probably will not.
Well, it's an interesting thing. You talk about this Brexit and the disruption there. On Monday morning, if you look at where Fed futures were trading, the probability of a rate cut, not a rate increase, was 20%, and the probability of a rate hike was 7%. So almost 3 times more likely to see a cut than to see a rate increase. After a couple of days of rallying in the equity markets and cooler heads prevailing, those odds have kind of switched places again, and the probability of a hike is now 11.8, and no one's really realistically expecting a cut any longer. But yeah,
this turmoil and this uncertainty, even on the part of the experts, makes people really nervous, should it?
Well, I think it's the Fed is in a difficult spot. I mean, they didn't used to do this. They didn't used to say what their plan was going to be for, you know, where Fed funds were going to be. This is since 2012. They've only been doing this. In fact, before the early 1980s, they didn't even say what their target rate would be for the Fed funds. You just had to kind of infer it by open market operations of the Fed. So I don't know. To some extent, they've put themselves in a bad spot by, you know, having to lay out precisely where they think short-term rates will be.
Why have they changed that practice? Why are they doing this?
Well, I suppose the intention there is to try to signal to financial markets the direction where they're going to be taking rates. But as they've said many times, they've got to remain data dependent. And, you know, the data hasn't been moving the way that they expected it to be.
John, prior to the start of 2016, you said indicators were pointing toward a solid year. And now you're predicting sluggishness for the rest of the year. Is that strictly because of uncertainty over the British exit from the European Union, or are there other factors at work?
No, there are other factors. As was reported, I think, yesterday in the revised GDP number, it reminds us how weak the first quarter was. You mentioned earlier about the weak jobs report last month. Those things, there just seems to be a general slowing of the economy. But there is some good news out there. There are some things that are positive. We see the home prices continuing to rise. In the Case-Shiller Index, we've seen the highest price for Charlotte homes on record, was just released the other day, and we've in I think 5 or 6 other cities. And in addition to that, you know, we've seen some other good news. Consumer confidence was up to one of its highest levels last month. And so those are very, very important things going forward. So what we're in is that period, Mike, of mixed signals. And if you remember back coming out of the 2008-2009 recession, remember, we were in that period of time where we were getting mixed signals. We'd get 1 or 2 good things and 1 or 2 negative things, and just wouldn't seem to take off. Now we're on the other side of that, and we're getting a couple of good things, but we're also getting a couple of negative things. So I think that we're in the period of time where we're mixed signals. We've had a really long run of economic expansion. And to quote several commentators I heard yesterday talk about this, we're just muddling along right now. And there's nothing really to send us in either a positive or a negative direction. We're just bumping along at probably, for this year, probably around a 2% growth.
Just about 8 years ago, we entered this great recession, and a lot of indicators, as you just said, have come back from that. We had all this economic expansion despite the uncertainty right now. The levels of unemployment have recovered. The stock market has recovered. Home prices and home sales have recovered. Car sales have recovered, and on and on and on. And yet we cannot seem to break out of this feeling of economic weakness, which is one reason, I guess, the Fed has yet to increase interest rates. What is holding us back? Why are we in this doldrums?
Well, I think there are a couple of secular factors that are different today than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. For one thing, we've got a very, very slow population growth in this country. And I've said this on the show before, but I remember back when I was in graduate school, and I won't even say how long ago that was, my professors told me there are two things that lead to economic growth, growth in the labor force and growth in productivity. You add those two growth rates together, that's your potential GDP growth. And if we've got a labor force that's basically stagnant, the population growth that's maybe running at about 1%, 0.75%, then any type of growth we're going to get is going to come out of productivity. And over the last 3 or 4 years, that's sort of stagnated as well, probably less than 1.5%. Sometimes, some quarters, it's less than 1%. So you put those two numbers together, you add up those two numbers, and you get about a 2% growth rate. And that's really, that's the only sources of economic growth that you have, are productivity gains and labor force growth. And with those being basically stagnant, this is what you get.
What about demand for products and services? And it's a global economy, so our products are going, one would presume, all over the world. Why isn't that driving things up?
Well, I think it's a fair point to talk about how it fits in the context of the global economy. And I think to some extent we can feel better about the growth dynamics that we have in the U.S. I mean, we've got a lot of hand-wringing and navel-gazing here over why we're only growing at 2%. And I'll grant you that's short of the long-term potential growth rate for the U.S. economy, which is closer to a little more than 3%. On the other hand, when you look at all the other large advanced economies of the world, they would be doing anything to get 2% growth. They've got, you know, stagnant growth, flat or falling prices, and the growth dynamics that we have here, humble though they may be, look relatively good compared to the rest of the world, where banks, central banks, are pulling their hair out, offering negative interest rates and expansionary monetary policy, and it still doesn't seem to be working to stimulate demand and growth.
And all of this dates back to the Great Recession.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were the catalyst for the global recession of 2009. I mean, it was our financial crisis here in the U.S. that sort of, you know, spurred that whole slowdown. And the recoveries have been mixed around the world.
Banks and mortgage companies led the way in that Great Recession. How are they doing now, Dion?
Well, you've certainly seen banks, you know, here in Charlotte and elsewhere, return to profitability. And as we saw yesterday, you know, banks across the country increased, big banks increased their dividends, Bank of America being one. And, you know, I think that is a positive sign that points to positive activity within our banks. You know, and of course, you're also seeing layoffs in the banking industry as they, you know, adjust to a changing economy.
Bank of America yesterday afternoon, there was some, as I was putting together the show, actually, I was going to ask you a question about the pressure that Brian Moynihan, who's the chairman and CEO of Bank of America, has been under by shareholders to increase the stock dividend. It's been stuck at 5 cents a share for a long time, and they were really impatient to raise that dividend. They passed the stress test recently, and as a result of that, I think, Mr. Moynihan felt secure in raising the dividend, or his board of directors felt secure in raising the dividend by 2.5 cents to 7.5 cents. Is that a big deal?
It is a big deal. You know, it's good news. It's good news for the shareholders, and it's good news for the bank. You know, again, it points to the recovery that this company, you know, continues to experience.
Well, I was going to ask you, will investors be pleased? But then I read, I think, a story about by you this morning in the paper that said essentially they want more.
Well, they, you know, some will be happy to see this. I mean, look, the dividend's up 50%, and they also said they were going to buy back $5 billion in stock. So they're clearly returning more capital to shareholders. But, the dividend is still below the bank's peers, and it's not where it was before the recession. And part of that is a function of the bank has a lot of outstanding shares. That it's increased the number of shares since the downturn, basically, or going back before the downturn. It has more shares. That's diluted a lot of shareholders. So anytime they can return more capital, it's good news. But again, it's the dividend lags its peers, and that's something that, as you see in my story, some shareholders are concerned about.
And why does it lag its peers? Is it because they got themselves to such a great big hole during the recession?
Well, again, so not to get too far in the weeds on it, but when the bank purchased Merrill Lynch and Countrywide back mm-hmm. in 2009 and 2008, it had to issue more shares to raise capital to help fund those purchases. So you're looking at a bank that went from about 4.5 billion shares to now 10 billion shares. So you're spreading your capital across many, many more shares than you were, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. So, they would have to have, quadruple maybe, the amount of capital that they're spreading out there to get back to 64 cents a share, which is where they were. Yeah. Prior to the downturn.
Wow.
So they just have way more shares today than they did, before the recession. And, you're spreading your capital across just a wider swath of shares, and that means that you can't get back to 64 cents easily.
And the Fed has kept the interest rates remarkably low for 8 years or so now. That's bad for savers, good for borrowers. What is it for the banks?
Well, I guess it's mixed for banks because on the one hand, it could cause people to, it could cause people to take out loans, take out mortgages. The lower the rates are, obviously, the more attractive they are, the more attractive mortgages are, the better it is for the housing market ultimately, which is, that continues to recover. It's bad for banks in the sense that, especially banks, smaller banks, community banks, they're so reliant on the interest that they make off of you and me. Mm-hmm. They don't have capital markets activities and these other types of business models, these other levers they can pull to bring in more revenue. So when you're so reliant on interest rates, anytime interest rates are low, that's bad for your profitability.
What about banks the size of Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Citibank?
It's not a positive for them necessarily that interest rates are low because they would like to see their net interest margins be higher. But again, they have more levers to pull. They have more diverse business models than your smaller banks, so they're able to weather this a little bit better than your mom and pop banks, your community banks.
As you point, go ahead, John.
If I can just interject something on top of this, the world as we know it is awash in loanable funds, and that's just driving the price down. This is not something in terms of this interest rate environment that we see now. This is not something that's going away next week. No matter what the Fed does. And I think what the Fed is doing is indicative of where money rates are right now, simply because there are a lot more savers than there are borrowers, and that's sort of held artificially low, the number of borrowers. We have seen a significant change in the credit requirements and risk requirements to loan funds out. And as a result of that, we just have a whole lot more savers than we do borrowers right now, and that just drives the price of money down.
And with that, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. The American middle class, the backbone of our economy, as long as we're talking about the economy, is allegedly collapsing. These are the workers, the middle managers, small business owners, who have fallen victim to rising economic inequality. Their wages have been stagnant for years. Employment uncertain, and their debt levels have been rising, and they're facing increasing child care and health care costs and education costs. We're going to hear from the author of a book about why this has been happening and what to do about it on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more airbag recalls this week, and VW agrees to pay nearly $15 billion in its emissions cheating scandal. And cars with driverless technology are now available. A look at auto safety and consumer trust.
The Diane Rehm Show, following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy and banking today with Tim Quinlan, the senior economist at Wells Fargo, Dr. John Connaughton, professor of financial economics at UNC Charlotte, and the keeper of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. I'm not sure where he keeps that. Maybe in a mayonnaise jar on Funkenwagnall's porch. I'm not sure. Dion Roberts is also here, banking reporter from the Charlotte Observer. We just talked about, the world being awash in loanable funds, and essentially that the restrictions on giving credit to people have been tightened, which means fewer people are getting credit, I guess. Is that true? And if so, if that's true, why is the housing market flourishing?
Well, again, it's doing better, but it's not nearly at the same levels that was before this all began back in 2006 and 2007. I think that the other thing that I ran out of just a little bit of time was to simply say that as a result of this, it's become a very competitive market for banks in terms of lending funds, which has driven down their spread between what they pay for money and what they're able to charge for money. And that spread, which is, you know, where their profit is and where they make their money, that spread has been narrowed over as a result of the change in the financial markets these days. And that's made them potentially less profitable than they were before this all began.
Okay. And with interest rates so low, beginning with the Federal Reserve, have they used up everything in their bag of tricks to manage the economy going forward?
Well, you know, I think part of the rationale for delivering on that rate increase in December and part of the reason why they're trying to raise rates this year is to some extent reload the gun so that when the next recession comes along, mm-hmm. they've got the bandwidth to be able to deal with it. Now, they're not going to say that. They'll say it's strictly their, you know, mandates of, you know, full labor market and low and stable inflation. But, you know, when you look at the state of the job market, relatively weak payrolls report that you already discussed in May, and inflation that's well below the Fed's target. This doesn't feel like an economy that's overheating so much that the Fed needs to step in and take away the punch bowl.
Yeah.
This is more trying to get ready for next time.
The Fed projects 2% growth annually over the next 3 years, a rise in consumer price inflation of 2%, unemployment rate below 5%. Are those meager numbers, good numbers in some sense? What do you see? Do you agree with those numbers?
Well, you know, the Fed's got a little bit of a credibility problem with its forecasting here. I mean, if I were to show you the Fed's forecast for what inflation would be in 2016, the year that we're currently in, and you go back to 2014 and 2015, they imagined the same sort of thing. The future is always bright, and you know, you've got steady growth, low inflation, and they're raising rates. And when it comes time to actually deliver on it, it's been more difficult for them to do that. Our forecast at the beginning of this year was for full year growth of, I think, 2.2 or 2.3%. We were well below consensus at the time, but now even that forecast feels a little overly optimistic as, you know, growth dynamics really fail to be firming up to what many people had expected.
John, did you agree with those Fed numbers, or did you have a different outlook?
Well, no, I think they're on target in terms of a 2% growth. I don't really see anything in the next 6 to 9 months that's out there saying this thing's going to turn around or going to change significantly. One point I would like to make about the Fed is they missed their opportunity about a year and a half ago to start raising rates and provide that maneuvering room that Tim talked about. And I think that's very insightful on Tim's part, that really what's going on here more than anything else is the Fed's, I think, realization that going forward, you know, we've been on this expansion. This is the fourth longest expansion on record. I guess that shocks a lot of people, and that's out of 33 since 1854 that the National Bureau of Economic Research keeps track of the business cycles. So this has been a very, very long expansion, and I'm not suggesting to you this is like gravity, what goes up must come down, but we all know that we're getting into that period of time where we're starting to push the envelope as to how much longer this can go on. When you're sitting at zero interest rate, you have no maneuvering room. You've got no powder, if you will,
right,
to fight the next downturn.
The, now,
Their balance sheet is way out of control at $4.7 trillion. To put that in perspective, it was about $800 billion back in 2007. And so they're looking for tools. They missed the window, as I say, about a year and a half ago. They could have slowly increased the rate, and we could be sitting now at a 1.5% rate, which would still be roughly zero in terms of a real interest rate. And they just chose not to do that. There are many on the Board of Governors and on the FOMC particularly that wanted to do that, but the chair at the time did not want to raise rates.
Both Bank of America and Wells Fargo recently passed the stress test, which were put in place by the federal government, I guess, to make sure that in case of another financial meltdown, these banks would not fail, because we don't want to have to bail them out yet again. But in order to pass these stress tests, what have they had to do that is impacting either their share value, the bottom line, their ability to lend money, et cetera, to do business? What have they had to do that may be impeding them in some way?
So the biggest thing that the stress tests are designed to do is to measure capital levels. So how much capital does a bank have socked away to absorb loan losses? So when the economy starts tanking again, whenever that may be, people will stop paying on their loans. The banks will start, posting losses on those loans. Do they have enough capital to weather that?
So that's money out of play.
That's money that they can't give back to shareholders. And so to your question about how does this impact shareholders, there you go. That's less capital that they can return, which is one of the things that has theoretically hurt their stock prices and made them less attractive to investors.
The U.S. housing market is on solid ground, at least according to Wells Fargo Securities or Wells Fargo economists. And you say that's likely to remain a bright spot. But in order to buy a house, consumers have to be pretty optimistic about their chances of keeping their job, pretty optimistic about the future of the economy, at least the short-term future. They have to be able to get a loan in order to buy a house, most people. If that optimism is back, people are getting home loans. Why is the economy so fragile?
Well, first on the point about the housing market, I do think that is one of the pieces of the U.S. economy that's on, let's say, the least wobbly fundamentals at the moment. Things look relatively decent there. We've had a slow pace of residential construction activity the last few years. That has allowed the market to absorb a lot of excess inventory that's been out there. You look around in the Charlotte market and how long, decent homes in any neighborhood stay on the market. It's a very, very short time.
Right.
That stuff's got to get picked up. And the residential construction activity has a multiplier effect in other parts of the labor market. So that's relatively decent. But this lending dynamic that you talk about is really kind of the crux of things, because you see, when you look at the last 9 years, we have increased the number of renters for 8 out of 9 years. We have decreased the number of homeowners in 8 out of 9 years.
Is that why we're seeing in Charlotte so many of these apartment buildings going up?
Well, that's a big piece of it. I mean, these multifamily units are more attractive to somebody that may not qualify for a conventional home loan, and so these become an option for them. But that's not the only option. You also have firms like BlackRock out there buying single-family homes, many of them in Charlotte, and then renting those homes out to people that might otherwise in a previous era have qualified for a home mortgage. And instead of owning a piece of the American dream, they're renting it from an asset management company.
Yeah.
So on the housing market, we're talking about how well it's doing, but there's kind of a dark side to what's going on in housing. So when we talk about the health of the housing market, home prices are soaring. As John said earlier, we hit record prices in Charlotte, record home prices in March of this year. And then in April, they went up even more. That's because there's a shortage of housing on the market. There's not enough new home construction taking place. And this is not just in Charlotte. This is nationwide. And these alarm bells are being sounded, by the way, by the National Association of Realtors economists.
If there's a demand, why aren't they building houses?
Well, Mike, if we go back to the initial question you asked about essentially the capital requirements of the banks, there are two aspects to what Dion was talking about there. One is the amount of capital you have to have and you basically keep away from your shareholders. That's basically been doubled, okay, the requirement of capital for the banks on their balance sheet. The second thing is that one of the ways you can pass the stress test is to have less risky loan portfolio, because what they're doing is they're looking at how risky that loan portfolio portfolio is to figure out how many people are going to stop pay or slow pay and how much capital you're going to need to cover that. So if you have a very risk-free portfolio, okay, by charging or by looking at very high FICO scores, then you put yourself in a position to fare better on these stress tests. And we've seen banks basically do that. That's the problem that you've talked about. It's what Tim was talking about in terms of the home ownership going down. The requirements to get a loan today and the FICO score that you need are so much higher than they were 10 years ago that it really is reduced the number of people who can own a single-family home significantly. And by the way, Mike, there's nothing wrong, and they're not real risky if you've got a 675 FICO score. You're not going to get a home loan now, but it's that score is someone who's missed a bill or two along the way, hasn't stopped paying, but just missed the bill, a couple of late pays. That'll put you in the 600 range in a FICO score.
Wow. You want to finish your thought, Dan?
Well, so on top of the challenges of getting a mortgage, you know, and as John's talking about, FICO score is one aspect. There's just more paperwork now. I mean, you know, it used to be before the financial crisis, you could go into a loan officer's office and say, you know, I made $200,000 last year. Oh, really? Okay, well, here's a mortgage. That's one piece of it. There is more paperwork, but the other aspect, again, is the rising home prices. I mean, when you're looking at 5%, 6%, year-over-year home price increases, you know, outpacing inflation, wages are not going up that high, or not increasing by that percentage year-over-year. So if you're a first-time home buyer, it's difficult for many people to afford that. And so that's pushing people into the rental market. And you just have to wonder about, you know, long-term stability in the community and people's long-term commitment to the community if they're renters. And I'm not disparaging renters here, but we know that people who, buy homes tend to, in many cases, be more invested in the community. There are other.
It's harder to leave.
It's harder to leave. You know, you're committed and you're tethered a little bit more. And so, it just raises all sorts of questions about long-term impacts.
Scott emails, you reported that single-family home values in Charlotte now exceed the peak before the Great Recession. Can your guests expand on this? Is the statistic based on sales prices? If so, is the statistic misleading because there are so few entry-level home sales?
I wrote earlier this week that story. So that's based on the Case-Shiller data that came out Tuesday. Yes, we are above not only our pre-recession prices, but we are at a peak now, an all-time peak in Charlotte for home prices.
So are they building fewer entry-level homes because people at that level can't get the loans they need to buy those homes, or because these buyers have shifted their focus and decided to be renters?
Part of it is builders are still ramping up. You know, there was a pause on new home construction in the downturn, for obvious reasons, and that's starting to come back. And you know, but part of the problem is there are not enough developed lots. You know, it takes time to get these lots developed and subdivided, and then you start construction. And you know, there's also been challenges for builders to get loans. That's probably improving now. As the economy's improved and home buyer demand has come back. But a lot of it is there's just a lack of lots that are ready for construction.
Let's go back and talk more about the economy, particularly about the impact of Brexit, because that's the big news of the last several weeks. Markets around the world reacted negatively to Brexit. They began to recover very quickly after that, however. Stock markets we're talking about, but stock markets are not economies. What fallout should we expect in the Carolinas, if any, from Brexit, no matter what happens over there?
I'll jump in here. Dan, remember we had this conversation on Friday. I don't really think that this is a big issue for the United States or the Carolinas. And let me explain why that is. I hear people talk about, you know, trade deals and all that. What people have to understand right now is that the United States does not have any type of trade deal with the European Union. It doesn't. There's talk about doing one, but we don't. But yet we have pretty much free trade amongst the members of the EU, primarily because of something known as most favorable nation status. And they all qualify for that. Whether Britain's in the EU or Britain's out of the EU, they're going to qualify for most favorable trade status and most favorable nation status, which means that goods should flow in and out of the Britain and the United States the same as they do now. We're not all of a sudden going to put or slap tariffs on Minis or Range Rovers or, heaven forbid, Rolls Royces. And consequently, the Brits aren't going to do the same for, you know, Apple products and what have you. I think that basically the terms of trade are not going to change between us and Britain.
Is Britain one of the more healthy economies in the European Union?
They are the most healthiest economy.
Okay, so if they exit from the European Union, and the European Union is already having a tough time with recovering from the recession, and they've got big problems in Greece and big problems in Spain and a couple of other countries, their exit, does that not throw the European Union into a weakness that might affect trade?
I think it's definitely a weakness for the European Union, but a number of different groups have looked at this: the World Bank, the IMF, the OECD, the British Treasury themselves, and the kind of consensus takeaway from those analysis of the implications of Brexit universally say that it would be a bigger downward hit to the UK economy than it would be to the Eurozone.
Okay. One of the reasons that British voters chose, we are told, to exit the EU was anger over the results of globalization. And you just talked, John Connaughton, about this being the fourth largest expansion in our economy, and there are a lot of people who simply would be surprised by that, who are not experiencing that, don't understand that, and don't believe it. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of angry people, which is partly fueling the candidacy of Donald Trump for the exact same reasons that these people in Britain voted to exit the Union. Is there anything that can be done, that should be done, to alleviate the pain that these people are feeling in this fourth largest expansion that they are not experiencing?
You asking me?
I'll take it from anybody.
Well, I think that there have been a lot of trends that have kind of caught up to us. One of the fallacies, and we've talked about this on the show before, Mike, is that somehow or other global trade has cost me my job. And there are certainly anecdotal evidence about some jobs that move. And again, Mr. Trump occasionally comes up with, for example, Carrier that's thinking of moving a plant from Michigan to Mexico. And so there's a piece of anecdotal evidence about a set of jobs that are moving. But the real issue has been really technology has taken away a lot of those manufacturing jobs. If you go into a manufacturing plant today, it's a world difference than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Far fewer people on the line, machines, robots doing much, much more. I recently visited an auto plant and where they do the platforms, which is essentially the floor plan and everything else that's built that everything else hangs on.
Right.
There's not a single person in there putting that thing together. It's like 4,000 pieces that go into making one of these platforms. And it's all machines, robots, welders.
Right.
There are a couple of guys and gals sitting up in the second, third floor watching computers.
And with that, we have to stop, John. We'll come back with more. And Tim wants to talk about this too at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum, presenting All That Sparkles, a 20th century jewelry exhibit from Beckler Collection artist Alberto Giacometti and Nikki de Saint-Fall. The exhibit opens tomorrow, details at Beckler.org. Well, there were more airbag recalls this week, and VW has agreed to pay nearly $15 billion in its emissions cheating scandal. Meanwhile, cars with driverless technology are becoming available, but whether they will make us safer is up for debate. So, on the Diane Rehm Show, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they take a look at auto safety and consumer trust. Can we trust our cars? That's coming up. If you'd like to join our conversation, can we trust the economy or the stock market or the banks? Well, now's your shot. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. We're coming right back.
This week, on All Things Considered, there are 47,000 homeless people in the Los Angeles area. More and more of them are women.
I came downtown on Skid Row in 2003. That's when the bottom fell out of my life.
And on the streets.
I saw killings. I saw people get raped.
Plus, a look ahead to what happens to Britain after its break from the EU. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy, where we've been, where we're going, with Tim Quinlan, the senior economist at Wells Fargo, John Connaughton, professor of financial economics at UNC Charlotte, and the keeper of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. Dion Roberts is also with us, banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I want to let you finish your thought, John, about manufacturing and job loss and the economy that has been on an expansion now for quite a while that a lot of people are not experiencing.
Right, and just to follow up on that, it's very popular to say that somebody's stealing your job, that somebody else, some other person in some other country is stealing your job. But the reality is, it's the robot that's stealing your job. It's the computer that's stealing your job. Routine tasks, whether they're performed on goods or services, are basically now being done by machines.
And Marshall Brain, who is with, I think, NC State University, was on this program, said, and he said, fundamentally said that in the future, all the jobs, all of them,
I don't know if all of them
will be done by robots.
I don't know if we're going to go that far. But
for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
Did you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, I think your question was, what will fix it and what will cause this to be a more broadly participated in recovery? And I think when John has kind of set this up really well. He's had, where we are in the expansion. And by the way, I thought this was why we did this show today. We're at a milestone date here. I'm sure you know this. The economy actually turned in the summer of 2009. The last month of recession was June. The first month of expansion was July of 2009, so happy seventh birthday for this expansion tomorrow. again, John said your average expansion lasts a little less than 5 years. We're past our expiration date. The money supply has been growing, and it doesn't seem to be working. So I think to answer that question of yours is why isn't this more broadly participated in? It's because you've been throwing all this extra money into the system. You've been applying monetary policy solutions and have not been really doing any things in terms of fiscal policy.
The exit of Britain from the European Union was largely driven by people who were unhappy by not being able to participate in this economy, and globalization was the boogeyman. What have been, if any, the benefits of globalization, particularly to the people who are complaining about it the most?
Oh, gosh, there's tons of benefits.
What are they? Because they don't recognize them.
Well, they might not appreciate the fact that the cost of many of the goods that their clothes, their shoes, their manufactured products are far less. If these people in London were having to go down to Savile Row and have their clothes stitched by a London seamstress, they'd be paying, $2,000 for a suit of clothes. It's absurd for them to dismiss the much lower cost of goods, lower cost of
goods. So the Walmart economy is in part due to globalization?
Why, sure. I mean, the fact that you're able to – the average low-income American today lives better than the King of England did 200 years ago in terms of the things that they're able to afford and the services they're able to have.
Well, NPR's Marketplace conducted a survey on Americans' feelings about the economy. They were told that more people are worried about their financial situation. They are less confident that they could find a job in 6 months if they were to lose their current job. And perhaps most troubling, 71% of Americans from across the economic and political spectrum believe that U.S. economic system is rigged in favor of certain groups. 71% of the people say that. When 71% believe that the economy is rigged, what should we do about that? What does that say?
I'll take a run at this. I think that the number one, and I don't dispute that figure, but we've just gone through a year of listening to Mr. Trump and Mr. Sanders tell us basically the same thing, that the economy is rigged. And so it's very comfortable to blame somebody else for your troubles and not take responsibility for it. And that's a harsh statement, I know, but the fact of the matter is when we look at the hard data, we're at roughly a 5% rate of unemployment. That's pretty much the benchmark rate. To use the Fed term, that's the NARU rate, the non-accelerating inflationary rate of unemployment.
Well, I also think it has to do with the fact that Mr. Trump and Mr. Sanders and many, many other people, and all you have to do is read the newspaper to find this out, are looking at the haves and the have-nots. And you're seeing these CEOs making these enormous salaries. You're watching the county commission give itself a 43% raise. When's the last time you got a 43% raise? I've never gotten one. And when's the last time people have gotten a raise of any consequence? That's part of the problem, isn't it? The CEOs are getting paid, but they're not paying the rank and file.
Mike,
yes.
Just step back for a second. If you're talking about the concern that people have over the political elite, which was also an issue in the Brexit vote, and certainly an issue here, that's something different than saying the economy is rigged. Okay, I think that the political system may in fact be rigged for the haves and the have-nots, but I'm not sure that the economy is necessarily rigged. I mean, to a great extent, an awful lot of what takes place in the U.S. economy today is market-oriented, buyer and seller.
Right.
It doesn't happen unless two parties get together and voluntarily agree to exchange assets.
Well, the fact that they're identifying the economy as being rigged could be a stand-in for the system being rigged, and they're just using the incorrect terminology. Dion, you wanted to talk about this, too.
So, you know, John was talking earlier about, you know, people being concerned about losing their jobs to another country or to foreigners, and you know, as we talked about on the show, that is happening to some extent in Charlotte with the H-1B visa program, as people from, you know, particularly India, about 70% of the H-1B visa workers in the country are born in India, and so, you know, people in IT in the U.S. Are losing their jobs now. You know, in 2016, to people from India who are coming here and taking over their positions. So some of that is happening as companies try to cut costs and seek, in some cases they're doing it to cut costs and seek cheaper labor.
And Tim, the impression among a lot of people is that wages have been and continue to be stagnant. But according to a report from Wells Fargo Securities, home sales are being fueled by the resilient job market, the extended run of low mortgage rates, and continued gains in personal income. Incomes are rising for whom?
It's been a very recent dynamic. And frankly, when you look at this expansion, we've kind of talked about it being kind of long in the tooth here. It took the labor market a lot longer to recover than the economy. So if you look at GDP, for example, it was back to pre-recession levels in 2011. How long did it take to get all the lost jobs back? It actually wasn't until the middle of last year, 2015, before we got all the – so it's been very late for this labor market recovery to show up. But it's an interesting thing what's kind of happened that sets the table for this wage income and wage increases. You mentioned the survey of people that feel like the system is rigged and, you know, everybody's out to get them. But what people say and what they do are very different. Consumer spending is approaching all-time highs. And here's an interesting one. Quits, the number of people walking away from gainful employment – a few months ago hit not only its highest level in this expansion, but higher than it did at any point in the prior decade. And that's a good thing, Mike. Let's hear it for the quitters, because when people quit their job, think of it from the perspective of a business manager or a business owner. If you're losing good talent, what can you do to retain the existing people that you've got? Start to raise wages, and you're starting to see that.
And these people are quitting because either they're getting better jobs or they think they will get a better job.
Absolutely. These are not terminations or retirements.
So why are people still feeling this way? Why is the message of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and the whole Brexit thing, why is that resonating with so many people?
I can't begin to explain Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or what makes them say the things that they do, but I know that the conference board's measure of consumer confidence rose to 89 yesterday.
But it is true.
That's a long benchmark of
consumer confidence. Surely it's true that wages have been stagnant. Surely it's not like it used to be in the 90s or even the early 2000s.
And that's what John Connaughton was talking about earlier in the program when he talked about productivity. You know, you typically, when you have periods of strong productivity growth, you associate that with strong income growth. The productivity has been really lacking in this cycle. But at this point, with the unemployment rate now below 5%, job openings at a 30-year high, you're starting to see wages pick up.
So, John, We talked in the aftermath of the Great Recession of this being the new normal, whatever that meant back then. I've forgotten now, but it was depressing, and I've blotted it from my mind. Are we still in the new normal? Is this the malaise that people are still feeling from having to realize that they can't go to Nordstrom every week and buy something? You know, or
a blast from the past, Mike. Yeah. Malaise. I haven't heard that in 30 years.
Thank you, Jimmy Carter.
How'd that work out for Jimmy Carter?
Not well.
But back to your point, where are we compared to where we were 8 or 9 years ago when this thing all began? And this notion of a new normal. I think we're away from that new normal where everybody was tightening their belt and, you know, playing board games instead of using electricity to watch TV and so on. I mean, we're not in the go-go days of the 90s or even the early 2000s, but the economy is much, much healthier today than it's been any time in the last decade. And I think that I just don't think, despite the fact that this expansion has been going on for 7 years and has been the fourth longest out of 33 that we've recorded, I don't really see an end to this right now. What I do see, though, is a continuation of this slow growth. And there are multiple things that are doing this. But one of the things that concerns me the most going forward, and that's over the next several decades, is the aging of the population, not just the U.S., but also in the Eurozone as well. That's something that is kind of uncharted territory in terms of how much older these populations are becoming and the effects that that's going to have on the economy, both in terms of demand, i.e., people not working and therefore not buying as many things, but also in terms of the services that they require. And we probably don't have time to go through it, but when you start looking at some of the CBO forecasts for deficits going forward over the next decade, you start to see the effect of the aging the population has 5-8 years out from now.
Buy healthcare stocks.
Absolutely. That and cafeterias, Mike.
I haven't seen a cafeteria in 20 years.
They're going to make a comeback, please.
One of you mentioned, with regard to the economy, personal responsibility. I don't know which one of you used those words. But how does that come into play here? If you're discontent, if you're feeling that the economy has left you behind, what have you done or not done that you should take responsibility for in that? And I don't know which one of you used those words. A deafening silence falls.
I was the one that used the word. I'm not sure exactly the precise term that I used, but I talked about the fact that it was easier to blame somebody else for taking your job than it was for you.
So what could I have, if I'm the one complaining about that, what could I have done?
I think for most folks, it's very, very difficult to deal with these issues when the economy, and let's go back 5 or 6 years, when the economy was not producing the jobs at the rate that it's producing now, and people were struggling. There was basically weakness in the labor market. There was a lot more supply of workers than there were demand for workers. Wages were stagnant, and it was hard to find a job. And people got pushed out of jobs that were very, very well paying, and now they're in the new environment where it was going to be very, very difficult for folks in their 40s and 50s to go find a job at the same pay rate that they had been getting. And that just takes a long time to work out through the economy. It's what Tim was mentioning. We're starting to see this upward pressure on wages now as a result of the tighter labor market.
We have 3 minutes left, and I want to cover two things before we run out of time. One is oil prices. They've been really low for a long time now. Gasoline prices at the pump have been, although they've risen a little bit, are still really low in comparison to what they have been historically. Where's that money going? What are people spending that newfound money on?
Yeah, I think it's been kind of disappointing. People point to the retail sales numbers and say, hey, where is all this money that we supposedly saved at the pump and are out there spending? I think it's gone to two places. If you look at, you know, we've talked before about inflation being very weak. Inflation is actually pretty high for rental income. In Charlotte, it's about 5% year over year for rents. And there's a lot of people listening right now that would say, I wish my rent only went up 5% last year. So rental income is consuming a big piece of that savings. And the other is healthcare. Healthcare inflation has been running well ahead of broader inflation. And that also
still, even with Obamacare.
I make no comment about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on healthcare prices, but in general, healthcare inflation has been higher, and that's taken a bigger wallet share for consumers.
And because so many jobs in this market are taken up by the banks have been experiencing a series of layoffs in recent both the big banks and probably others as well. Last month, Bank of America announced an unspecified number of layoffs in technology and a unit that handled distressed mortgages. That's probably good news because that means there are fewer distressed mortgages to handle. Are more cuts coming, and are most of these jobs being lost in Charlotte or around the system?
So, and so the second part of the question first, it's not just Charlotte, it's everywhere. It's nationwide. And a lot of it is in the mortgage area because, as you were saying, these are jobs that handle distressed mortgages and distressed borrowers. And we've been seeing fewer of those types of borrowers as the economy's improved. And so banks haven't needed as many of those staff members who work.
And because mortgages are more difficult to get, are there fewer people working in the good mortgage department?
I don't know the answer to that specific question, but with mortgage rates potentially staying lower for longer with this Brexit announcement, which can have ripple effects in the U.S. and cause the Fed to not raise rates maybe again this year, who knows. But, you could see banks staff up their mortgage staff.
We have 30 seconds. The two economists. Future, 2016-2017. Optimistic? Tim?
Mildly optimistic.
Mildly
yes.
Optimistic. John?
I would agree with Tim. Mildly optimistic. Another 2.5% growth for the next 18 months is quite plausible.
Dr. John Condon keeps the Babson Capital Economic Forecast at UNC Charlotte. Tim Quinlan, senior economist at Wells Fargo, and Dion Roberts, a banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thanks.
Charlotte.